Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. This is Elizabeth Hamilton and Katie Eastman with the Best Ever You Show, and we are absolutely delighted to have Alana Stewart with us today. Hello, Alana.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Oh, well, I'm good, thank you. Sitting here.
Hi, Alana.
Hi, how are you doing? Sitting here in the beautiful California sunshine, what could be better?
Oh, you're so lucky. We've got Maine gray and hopefully no Minnesota snow on the way here. So,
oh my gosh. Well,
I miss living there.
Well, but that's nice too. You have seasons. We have kind of seasons. It gets like, you know, chilly. Chilly in the wintertime.
Yeah, it's beautiful out there though. I love it. And I've got to just start this out by saying I can't believe in my lifetime I get to spend an hour with Alana Stewart.
Oh,
that's how
great.
I feel. Thank you so much.
Well, that's so sweet. Thank you so much.
I can't tell you how many times in my life I've wished that I could interview you. So this is a big dream come true. And,
oh my gosh! Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm honored.
So we wanted to start out though and ask you really what you wanted to spend the hour talking about. This is sort of your show in a way, and we want to know, you know, if you can spend an hour talking about anything. You know, we could easily spend the hour talking about how absolutely beautiful you are.
Well, you're
like,
so sweet.
We can just
sweet
talk about how pretty she is. For
what,
1 hour straight.
What a nice thing to talk about. But you know what? I don't feel that way at all. And if you could see me right now, I've got a friend of mine came over. A lovely friend of mine, his name is Tim Quinn, and he's director of Armani Cosmetics, and he's been a friend of mine for quite a few years, and he had a battle with cancer a few years ago, and he's fine now and back at work and looking great, but he went through a really, really, really tough time about the same time that Farah had cancer. But he was going to come over and have tea, and it was Sunday, and I had just gotten back from all this traveling, and I was exhausted, and I said, look, I hope you don't mind. I'm just really going to stay in my robe today, you know. And so I had an apron on because I had been making some banana muffins. And I went to the door to let him in, and my hair was like pulled back in like a little wad on the back of my head, and I had two clips holding the front of my hair up, and I was in my robe with no makeup and my glasses, and he did this big double take, and he said, you weren't kidding.
So you're real.
Oh, we love that.
I mean, he's seen me without makeup before because he's done my makeup for a lot of shows and things, but he's never seen me quite this bad. Even, I mean, I could just see he just visibly kind of pulled backwards and looked at me and went, wow, you weren't kidding.
Yeah, I was. I'm always thankful that this is blog radio, and there's a Skype feature on it as well that you could use if you wanted to. And I'm like, no, thank you. I wrote to our Best Ever You crew that I felt like to use Skype, I needed a light kit, a makeup artist, a hair artist, and everything. That's scary stuff, Skype. So.
Oh no, I mean, I don't want anybody. You know, if somebody calls you up on the phone, I don't want them seeing what I look like in the morning.
Exactly.
Right. The way I look, the way I walk around my house would scare anybody.
Well, and you know what we love about that, Alana, is that the show is all about being who you really are. And we love to interview people and hear those kinds of things because so many people have such misperceptions about famous people and what they're like in real life. And so we just love the fact that people say, hey, yeah, I'm in my robe, I'm in my sweats, and they're like us.
Well, you know, I feel like that it's really important to let your skin rest, you know, for one thing. And so I never wear makeup in the daytime unless I have a lunch or a business thing, something that I have to go to. I mean, I really walk around. If I go out and do my errands and things, I just wear big sunglasses. That's the answer. That's the ticket, big sunglasses.
Big sunglasses.
And I love to walk around my house. And when I was married to George, he used to tease me because I would get one robe, like, and it would be like a really old chenille robe like my grandmother would wear. But it would be like my comfort thing, and so it was like pink, and so I would wear it for years. I mean, just until it's like fell apart. You know, that was like my favorite thing. I would come home and get undressed and put my robe on. In the morning, I'd get up and put my robe on. Just...
So you're not sleeping in evening gowns is what you're saying.
No,
sure.
No, far from it. I mean, if anybody could see this, you know, the old pink chenille robe. I finally had to retire it. I think it had to get thrown away. But I always have one of those kind of robes. It's my, you know, it's like Linus and his blanket. It's like I have to have, it's my kind of my comfort thing.
Oh, that is hilarious.
So we're
just trying to figure out where to go with this. And I think, Katie, I think, do you want us to talk about Farrah a little bit?
Well, you know, I just came back from Florida, where I did a speaking engagement down there in Daytona Beach for a group of women. The Halifax Health puts on, it's a big health institute down there, and they put on this big health convention of women, and the topic was healthy women, and they had a panel afterwards of doctors and things. But I talked about Farrah and how she got sick and my whole journey with her, and I talked about our friendship and my book, and the reason my book was my diaries, basically, and the reason that I published them was because I really did do it in honor of the bravest, most courageous woman I've ever known. You know, she was just amazing. And it was also, I did it as a tribute to friendship, you know, especially friendship between two women, because I think that can be often one of the most important relationships in your life. You know, it's right up there with your mate and your children. You know, when
Katie.
It's the BFF
relationship. It's a really very special.
Yeah, and it's a very, you know, deep relationship, and you share everything, and sometimes you share a lot more with a woman friend than you do someone else, because, you know, you just, you can talk about everything and anything. And the experience Farrah and I went through when she became sick, though, I bonded us in a way that I've never, ever been bonded with a woman before, because, you know, when you go through that with someone and then in the end you lose them, they die, but you go through that experience of, you know, fighting for life with them. I mean, we were kind of like two warriors, you know, who were just out there, and we weren't going to take no for an answer, and you know, it just bonds you in a way that you can't imagine, and you sort of forget about all the other trials and things in your life. And it was one of the things I spoke about in this talk. I said, you know, before I found out she had cancer, before she found out she had cancer, I had a lot of problems going on in my own life. And, you know, that's another thing that people sometimes think, that they have a certain idea of people and that they have a blessed life or something, you know, and everything's always perfect in their life. I look at other people like that. You know, I look at people that I see in magazines or on TV or in the movies or whatever, and I think, oh, God, their life looks so exciting and glamorous and easy, and you know, my life just isn't that easy. And I don't think anybody's life is easy, but it's all relative. I mean, I was going through a difficult time with my health. I was going through a difficult time with what was going to happen to my future. I wasn't working. I wasn't making any money. I have family that has struggled with drug and alcohol addiction off and on for years. My two sons. I talk about it because it's common knowledge, you know. It's not something that they would be upset with me for speaking about, because, you know, they've spoken about it publicly, and touch wood, they're doing great now. But, you know, a few years back they weren't, and it just felt like my life was crumbling. I mean, it just felt like I just, every part of my, every area of my life was not working, and I was horribly depressed, and I remember talking to my good friend Marianne Williamson and her saying to me, look, you've just got to stop blaming yourself for all the decisions you made in your life that maybe you feel got you to this place. And, you know, because we always look back and go, why didn't I do this? And why did I do that? And why did I walk away from that? And, you know, why didn't I think about the future? And she said, you've got to forgive yourself for that. And you've just got to turn it all over and let it go and stop trying so hard to figure it out and fix it and, you know, turn it over to a higher power or God or whatever one chooses to call, you know, something higher than ourselves. And she gave me this prayer to say, and it was, God, show me how to be the woman you would have me be in order to do what you would have me do. And I just let go of everything, and I just started saying that prayer. Well, my life didn't change right away, but then suddenly Farah found out she had cancer. And I went to Germany with her 6 times over the course of over 2 years, and I kind of put everything, all of my problems, on the back burner because her life was at stake, so that took precedence over everything. And, you know, there were times when another trip would come up and she'd say, oh, I feel so bad. I know you've got, you know, problems with your house and things you need to deal with, and you've got your kids and your dogs. And I'd say, no, you know, I'm going. There just was no question. I'm going. And she would always be really glad I was going. But, you know, she would feel bad, like she was taking me away from my life or something. And I said, no, you know, I started this with you, and I said I would be here, and I am. So it just kind of went along like that, you know. And she didn't win the battle, obviously, and we thought she would at one point. That's when she decided to do the documentary, because she was doing so well, and, you know, it was going to be a documentary, Farah's story, about her finding a cure for cancer, because we went to Germany and we, you know, she tried all these different cures and things, and some of them really, really helped, and I believe gave her longer life than she would have had if she hadn't, and a better quality of life. But in the end, she, you know, she passed away, and it was, you know, certainly a devastating thing, and it, I'm certainly not over it. I mean, I'll never, really, it'll never...
I don't think any of us will be, though.
No, no, it'll never be. She'll never be forgotten in anyone's mind, and certainly not those people that were really, really close to her, you know? You just don't...
It's,
go ahead.
Well, and not only that, but one thing, I don't know if you know my background, Alana, but I've been working with dying children for years and helping families
go through that journey.
And,
Will you share your credentials and so forth so she understands completely who you are?
You're
Dr. Katie Eastman.
I'm CEO of an organization called Children's Palliative Care Community, and I have, as you just said, I've been walking with dying children and their families through this process. So I was so excited to interview you, because that documentary did something that those of us in the end-of-life field have been wanting to try and do for years, which is say it inspirationally, to present death in a way that people can see it and hear it and experience it without looking away. And one thing that I really want to ask you about, and what you just said was so important from a perspective of someone who's got a doctorate in psychology and a master's in theology, and all, I've been ologing for years on end-of-life care.
Oh, wow.
There is no such thing as closure. And I think a lot of people out there think there is. And one of the most wonderful pieces of works is called Continuing Bonds, where we recognize that when people die, they don't go away for us. We still talk about them. We still remember them. We still want to tell their stories. And I think that what you just said is so important for people to hear, is that, you know, Farah doesn't, you don't forget your friend. You don't find closure and forget that she ever existed. That's
oh,
not
no.
what grief is.
No, no, far from it. In fact, it's been, well, she died on June 25th, 2009, and there are times where I'm, you know, there's some days I'll just wake up and I'll be so unbelievably sad. I'll remember what we were doing this time, you know, 2 years ago or something. And that's another reason that I did the book, because I wanted to have something for me to remember her by, because, you know, as time goes on, you kind of forget details.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
what you did and where you were and things you did, and sometimes you just don't remember some of the little things. And so I did it for that and for people, you know, she had so many fans, so many people that loved her, and for other people, if they wanted to have something to remember her by and to look back at. And I keep the book by my bedside, and I pick it up all the time. I picked it up last night. Something, like, told me to pick it up. And I had this strong feeling, and it gives me chills right now to talk about it, because sometimes I feel her very, very, very close to me. And it's really sometimes hard for me to talk about, but I just feel her very close. And I picked up the book, and I was kind of going through a little problem emotionally, and I picked up the book and I just opened it to a page, and it was a page in which I was talking about the very same thing that I was dealing with in my mind at that time.
Yep,
it was just unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to, can I just tell you this really quick little story? I know I'm jumping all over the place here.
No, we love.
Please do.
This is your hour. I think we need 4 hours with you personally. I was like, I think one hour would be enough, but maybe we can have you on again. But yes, please.
Well, she and I had gone down to this friend's house in Mexico, and this beautiful, beautiful, beautiful house on a beach. And a year before she died, and she was feeling quite good at the time, and she loves Mexico and loves to lie in the sun and all that. So we had the best time. We went down with another friend, and we just, for a week, just sat in the sun and didn't leave the house and had guacamole and a margarita every now and then and Mexican food, and it was just heaven. I mean, it was really, really kind of the last fun time, you know, carefree time, I feel like, that she had or that we had together. And so I went back to this house by myself. I was with a friend, but I'm trying to think of when it was. It was this past January, and I hadn't been back since, you know, that time she and I had gone together. And I was sitting out exactly where we'd sat in the sun, and I was feeling really sad. I started to just feel so sad, and I started to get teary, and I went inside the house. It's a very open house, like they are in Mexico. But I went inside the house, and I sat down on a sofa, and I had a plate of watermelon with a piece of watermelon on it. And she and I had this watermelon juice, and every day we would drink fresh watermelon juice because it was so good down there. We'd eat watermelon. And I was sitting there, and I was watching outside, and there was this big white, I couldn't tell if it was a bird or a giant butterfly that kind of flew over the pool and flew around in a circle.
Wow.
No, but you listen. And I couldn't tell, and then it flew in the house, and it was a butterfly, but it was the biggest butterfly I've ever seen. It was pure white. It was the most beautiful butterfly. It was as big as your hand. And maybe bigger with the wingspan. I'd just never seen anything like this. I honestly thought it was a bird. And it flew around, and it got closer and closer to me, and it flew down, and it perched on my plate that was sitting in my lap. And with these two kind of black eyes, and it looked at me for what seemed like 2 or 3 seconds. It sat there and just looked at me, and then it flew off.
Mm.
And you can imagine what happened to me. I just started to weep. And I just knew that that was, you know, people may think I'm crazy, but I knew that was a sign. I knew that was her.
We are like, very much, Katie and I are all about all of that. Katie's book coming out is probably going to be called Butterfly Blessings, in fact. Every time.
Oh, you're kidding me.
No,
that's
in fact, every time,
I'm writing about that.
You go ahead.
That's a butterfly blessing.
Well, I don't know. Is that a special thing? I don't know anything about
it. The butterfly is the symbol for the transition from life to death. And oftentimes the butterfly is the hospice symbol used. And I had a similar experience. My friend and mentor was Elizabeth Kubler-Ross.
Oh, my God.
She told me,
friends with David Kessler.
Are you? Okay. Well, it's a small world. And Marianne Williamson, my God, would I give anything to meet her? She's been a guiding light in my life for years in her reading, but her writing. But she, Elizabeth, before she died, said to me, "You will know when I've died because I will come and pinch you as a butterfly. A butterfly will come and pinch you." And the day before she died, my daughter and I were out on the beach, and this big honking butterfly came and practically knocked me over. Well, I didn't know she had died yet. And so she literally was in her transition, what we call the transition phase, when that butterfly banged into me. And so I believe very strongly it was her. And children, I mean, I don't want to monopolize this, but there are a lot of stories about butterflies being messengers.
You know, and
when children died before they died in the concentration camps, they drew pictures of butterflies.
Oh my gosh.
So there's a whole thing about that, Alana, and not only just the butterfly, but those who go beyond often come in the form of an animal. And there are many, 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 many stories. So you are not crazy, and anyone listening, you are not crazy either when you believe that someone has come back to talk to you.
Oh, well, see, I didn't even know this, that this was, you know, I'd never heard this about butterflies before, but it certainly makes sense. And I just knew it. I mean, I just knew it. I've never had a butterfly. I've never seen one that big and that beautiful and white. And I've never had one come that close to me and sit on the edge of my plate.
Yeah.
I mean, a foot away from my face. It was her saying, "Don't be sad. It's okay. I'm in a better place. I'm free." And then she just flew away into the blue sky. And, you know, I think that it is true. And if we can grasp that when people make the transition that they are free, and they're free of that body and the pain of living and whatever they went through, physical, emotional, but we who are left here on earth are still not free because we miss them. We grieve for them.
And we do. And I wish more people would be honest about that. Because one of the saddest things I ever see in my work is what you've talked about, so important. You talked about it before she died. You guys shared in that beautiful film great footage of language that people could really learn from. And I think so often the saddest thing that happens is when people don't share what's in their hearts. Can you speak to that? I know it's hard for people to talk about things like that, but can you share some of what might help them do that when their friend is hurting or dying, or it doesn't even have to be dying?
Well, you know, the one thing I talked about too in this speech the other day is I talk about it in the last chapter of my book. I talk about the things that I learned, the gifts that I got from my experience with Farah, because she always said, "This is, you know, you're such a gift to me, that you would go through all this with me. And in the end, I honestly believe she was the bigger gift to me. My life changed so much. I started to look at things so differently. I can slip back into being, you know, very human, and, you know, my mind goes back into the, you know, those negative places like we all do. But when I'm really honest, the things that I learned, if I can just keep remembering, which is another reason I go back and read the last chapter of my book, one of the things I learned is that we really need to cherish the people in our lives that we love, and we need to let them know it, because life can change so quickly. We never know when something's going to happen, and we don't show people or tell people enough how much we love them. Sarah and I were both, you know, both Texas gals. We're not the kind that will sit and say, I love you so much, and you're my best friend. But it's just our actions were, you know, we'd write a note to each other for, you know, with a Christmas present or a birthday present, and she wrote the most beautiful notes, much more beautiful, really, and heartfelt than mine. And you know, we knew how close we were, and but we didn't talk about it, you know. And then as she got sicker and sicker, the other thing, we never talked about her dying. She never acknowledged.
Well, I wondered that.
Only thing she said was, she said a couple of times, when I have 2 months left, because she kept fighting. She kept believing there was going to be a miracle, a cure or something. And she said, if there comes a time when I have 2 months left, I want a doctor, someone to tell me, because I have affairs I have to get in order. But no one ever told her, because she was doing quite well, and then suddenly she started to just take a turn for the worse, and it progressively went down so quickly that she wasn't well enough to do those things that she would have wanted to do. So no one ever said that to her. And even before she died, in the last few days in the hospital, which I don't write about because I just felt that was too private and too personal. But there is one thing I do write about in the book. I did say to her, I had to say it because I hadn't said it. There was one night in the hospital when we were sitting there together, and I said, you know, I don't ever tell you how much you mean to me, and I just want you to know that you are
you're making me cry. Oh my gosh.
But I said, I just want you to know how much I love you and how much you mean to me, and how much being able to do the documentary that you know, with you, that you've had me do this filming, and that I've been a part of this because it's meant so much to so many people, and I just want you to know how much I love you like a sister. And she looked up at me, and at this point, she only had a few days left, and she could hardly speak, but she looked up at me, and she just said very softly, more than a sister.
Mm-hmm.
And that was our moment, you know, that we had. Yeah. But I knew that I had to verbalize, you know, not just by actions, but I knew I had to verbalize how much she meant to me. And what I learned from that is, you know, there are a lot of people that aren't mushy people, and they can't go around saying all the time how much they love someone. But there are moments, you know, there are moments when you can write someone a note, or, you know, my kids and I never hang up the phone without saying I love you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, unless we've had an argument.
And we needed laughter.
Then, you know, even then we'll call back and, you know, and, you know, at some point, it may be a day later, you know, or whatever, but we always end our conversations with I love you. And we always have ever since, you know, they were born.
Yeah.
But I know sometimes with friends or mates or something, we just don't let people know how much they mean to us.
Mm. Yeah, we don't. I know that my father wasn't able to tell me he loved me until he had cancer.
Oh.
And he'd shown it in many, many ways, but he finally said it when he had cancer, when he was on his last 5 years of life. And it really was powerful, but it just, some people just have a hard time with it. And I do agree with
your friend. I call you every day. I'm Katie.
Oh, no, she's just like, and my family, we do that all the time. I mean, my husband and my daughter, we do it all the time, but I have never had a friend who says it, and I'm still getting used to it. And it's really special, though. One of the things that happens is the connecting that happens when someone's dying. And what I loved about the film is you captured that so beautifully. And so many people are afraid of death and of walking that walk with someone. And one thing that I would love for you to speak to is, you know, a lot of times the sad thing is when people are afraid to say the wrong thing or do the wrong thing, so they do nothing.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I understand that because I even write about that in the book. I write... And by the way, I just want to mention it, and I'm not trying to plug it in this serious conversation, but if anyone wants to get it and read about these things that we're talking about right now that I'm sharing with you, it's called My Journey with Farah, and you can get it on Amazon and bookstores can order it. It's been out in paperback for a few months. It came out over a year ago, but it's in paperback now, and you can still get even hardcovers on Amazon. But the thing that I just wanted to mention that in case there's anybody who wants to
go. No, absolutely.
Well,
so they know what exactly.
I would like to read what she's talking about, and there's moments in there that are fun too. I mean, you know, it just wasn't depressing and sad because she had a great sense of humor, and so do I, and they're kind of similar. And we would find goofy things to laugh about, you know, in the silliest places. I mean, in, you know, in some operating room in Germany, you know.
Yeah.
We'd be giggling about some mean nurse, you know, who, you know, there was one we called Nurse Ratchet. And she would just always come in, and she was so mean, and she barely spoke English. And we would just be doubled over laughing. And, you know, here she is getting ready to have this you know, scary procedure. But we, you know, we just found a lot of things to laugh about. And because I did get off track, I totally forgot what you said you wanted me to address.
Oh,
well, no, you know what? Don't worry about it. Just go with it.
Yeah, no,
I just forgot, though, and I, you know, I do that. I forget things, and I know it was something about...
Well, just when people walk away because they're afraid to say the wrong thing, they don't say anything.
Oh, no, that was exactly it. You know, I talk about that in the book, too. I say, do you discuss dying with someone? What do you know, what do you say? How do you deal with it? I didn't know. You know,
right.
I'd never walked through that experience. And I think you kind of, in some ways, take the lead from that person because some people, I found out from, Farah had a nurse, a wonderful woman, and she, several of them, and we all became very close because they were there all the time, you know, toward the end, and so we were all sharing that time together, and you know, she didn't want to see a lot of people, and a lot of friends got offended, and even got offended at me because they'd call me up and want to come and see her, and I'd go and ask her, and she'd say, you know, I just don't feel like seeing anyone. She didn't want to see people. Other people do. It's very, and the nurse was telling me, and because I was saying, I don't know what to do. You know, their friends of hers call me up and they want to see her and they feel like I'm barring the door, but it wasn't up to me. It was really up to her because right up until, you know, just the day before she passed away, she knew what she wanted and was pretty clear about it. And so the nurse said, you just obey their wishes. You honor their wishes. If they want to see people, they do. And if they don't, you don't force it on them. And she said, I've been with many people who were dying, and I'm sure, you know, you have too. And she said, everyone deals with it differently. She
said,
I've seen people that didn't even want their family there.
Right. Right. And the most important thing is ask.
Yeah. Yes.
Show up and ask.
Yeah, and let them take the lead. And if they're still able to speak or communicate, you follow their wishes.
Yep, exactly.
So I'm not the trained professional in this, but I have a question back to the very beginning of when she did get sick. I remember being almost devastated as well, just in hearing that news, because you wouldn't think that something like that would ever, you don't think that something like that would ever happen to somebody like her.
No,
you
never.
Never.
She's the last person in the world.
I remember having to, you know, just listen to the news again, going, "No way, that's Farrah Fawcett. She can't be sick."
No,
you know,
she was like
why?
The golden goddess.
And so, but I never, you know, and again, loosely following it, you know, I'm not her close friend or anything like you are, but I didn't ever see any reaction from her where she was just so gosh darn mad that she was sick. She seems like more of a fighter and more of a positive person than taking it negatively.
She was a fighter.
Is that accurate?
And she never, absolutely accurate. And I think you probably get that from the film, too. She was a fighter.
Yep.
She was stubborn. She wasn't going to give up. But she never, there were times when she would, you know, there were a few times when she would just, it would just be so much pain, so much, and she would just cry and say, I don't know if I can keep doing this. And then she'd say, oh, I'm sorry, I'm being a baby. And I go, no, you're not.
Oh, geez, yeah.
Please, I couldn't do a fraction of what you've done. And then, you know, but she never was saying, why did this happen to me? Why?
Oh,
I mean, she was never angry, and
like
I know
that.
Sometimes people are. Sometimes they're just so angry. She was never angry. She was very matter of fact. She accepted that this had happened to her. It had happened to her for some reason. And even at one point when she, sort of halfway through, when she was actually doing pretty good at that point, and she said to the doctor, you know, she said, you know, I'm glad I got cancer. And the doctor said, well, why? And she said, because now I know I can make a difference. And that's when he decided to do the documentary, and then, you know, she wanted to help and encourage other people who were fighting cancer, and she also wanted to get people to think out of the box, and she wanted to kind of raise awareness of things that, of other, not necessarily other kinds of treatment, but things that people can do along with traditional treatment, or maybe instead of, whatever, you know, she just wanted, she wanted people to be aware of all the different options.
Now,
just take one doctor's word, and because she didn't have a great experience with her first round of when she first was diagnosed with cancer, and she just, you know, wanted people to not give up, and no matter what a doctor says to you, you know, don't go, you know, get other opinions, and a doctor's word is, you know, not God's law. And you know, she really, I guess her message really was, don't give up, you know, keep on fighting, and she did. And
are both of you aware, in a sense? I know you're both, you know, very, very famous, but when you're that famous, are you aware for real how much of an influence and role model you are to women around the country?
Well, I know that she certainly was. I mean, I'm certainly not anywhere in her league in that, in, you know, in that kind of celebrity and being well known, and but she certainly was, and she did start to realize how much people looked toward her and what she was going through, because everything was so public, you know. She didn't want it to be, but it just was. It was always in the, I've got to pick up my other phone because my battery's dying.
Oh, that happens to us sometimes. It's blog radio. We're used to
that. Yeah, we're used to that.
We've done entire shows with no guests before.
I know. I can imagine. So she started getting all of these letters from people, and they were all like, Farah, thank you so much for talking about your cancer, and you know, it gave me hope, and your strength and your determination has given me hope. I was ready to give up, and she got thousands of those letters.
What about even before that, though? Before she was sick, was she, was she aware that everybody cut their hair like her and you know, all that stuff? I can just remember being a kid going into the beauty parlor and saying, I need Farah's haircut.
Oh, yeah, I have
I think, you and half the young girls in America were doing that, you know.
We all had the Farah flip. I mean, we all did it.
Did she ever know? I just always wonder if people really understand that, you know, there's a whole Farah hairdo, and I'm sure they did, but I mean, I was just tiny. But I remember really distinctly making my mom take me in and pointing to this picture and saying, I need my hair just like her. That's she's just beautiful, and I need to look like her.
She really influenced a generation, a couple of generations, you know. So when she did get sick, people did watch her and look at her. Yeah. And she held her head up, and she was, you know, she was incredible. I mean, she really had incredible determination and strength and grace and dignity. And she, you know, I mean, she had her moments, as anybody would who's going through that. But she was an inspiration.
Well, I wanted to know if you would be willing to shift gears just a little bit and focus more a little bit on you. And maybe
I didn't really mean to get off, you know. About that. It just kind of went into that, and I'm talking to two friends now, and I don't feel like I'm on the radio or anything. So
That's how we like it. And also, your book is beautiful. Your book is so special, and the film is so special, and so you know. We had to pitch it. It's so important that people understand that they don't have to be afraid of death. It can be a really wonderful journey. So now you can shift back, Elizabeth.
I wanted to, if we can, just talk a little bit about you just being you, you know, being a mom and all the things that you do in your life. And, you know, you mentioned you had children. Can you talk, do you want to talk a little bit about your kids?
Well,
I'm a mom of four boys.
I've got two boys and a girl, but mine are grown. They're living out of the house, but I don't find myself a lot. I mean, obviously, when they were young and living in the house, I was pretty hands-on, and I was, you know, always there. But you know, now they're gone. But I still, you know, I remember my first husband, George Hamilton, his mother saying to me once, you don't stop worrying anymore about them when they're grown, you worry more. And,
oh, God, no.
And,
God, don't tell me that.
Right. Because,
great, thanks.
No, you know that thing they say, little kids, little problems, big kids, big problems? That's the way it is, I think. Because when they're grown, they have adult problems and bigger problems. And, you know, the thing that is the hardest for me to deal with in life is if my children are struggling or unhappy, are going through some unhappy situation or something's happened in their life, or I don't know if that's being codependent or if it's just being a mother. You know, I think it's just being a mother. You know, I'm so connected to them. And
I think that's just being a mom. My mom has
I think it's mom.
I lose count. There's 10 or 11
and
kids.
Dad.
I'm right in the middle of 10 or 11 kids, and I swear my parents are saints. They've seen it all and done it all, but she doesn't worry any less, and we're all grown as well. Yeah, I just think it's part of being a parent. I really do.
Yeah.
I
do too.
I mean, it's like you never really completely have a moment where, unless everything is all going great for all of them, and that's not usually the case. And the other day I was getting ready to walk out. I won't say which one because would be very upset with me. But I was getting ready to walk out of the house. I was dressed. I was going over to a friend's house for dinner. And one of my kids called and was very, very upset about something and wanted to come over. And, you know, I started to say, in fact, I did say, oh, honey, I'm just walking out the door. But you know what? Come over. Just come over. Mm-hmm. Never mind. Come mm-hmm. over. And I called my friends, and I just said, please understand. And they did. They said, don't be silly. It's family. And I stayed home with my kid, and we went, got a piece of pizza and, you know, just hung out and talked. And that's just the way it is. You know, they come first.
Yeah. Now, with your whole journey through life, you started out your career as a model. Is that correct? Were you signed? You're a Ford model.
I started. I moved from Texas to New York. I went with. I had saved up $500, actually, from a car accident I'd had. A man had rear-ended me on the freeway. I was
That's funny, but that you got.
I know. I was 18 and a half, and I was a stewardess for Trans Texas Airlines, if you can believe it. And I wanted to go to New York and be a model. I used to read about Gene Shrimpton and all these models, and it's all I wanted to do. And so I saved up my money, and I moved to New York. I didn't know a soul, and I stayed in this cheap little hotel on the West Side. And I finally got up the courage to walk into Eileen Ford's, and I saw her a couple of weeks ago in Houston. I went to this fashion event in Houston that was honoring Eileen Ford and my friend Len Wyatt. And I saw Eileen, and I hadn't seen her for quite a few years. And it was so great to see her. But, yeah, that's how I got started.
So do you recommend that for women? Do you love modeling or anything like that? Is that something that you... there's all these girls. It seems like every girl in the whole world wants to be a model, but there are certain things and requirements that I think anyway that you have to be realistic about and meet the requirements in order to be a model. For example, I used to think, oh my gosh, I want to be a model, and I'm 5'2". You know, so can you address some of the things just for? We have a lot of different listeners, and I know a lot. There's a portion of our audience that's listening to the modeling part of you, and they want to know how do you do that and so forth. And
well, I think
you know.
If you first of all, there were girls that even with Forge that were that weren't 5'9" or 5'10" or you know, I mean, for like fashion modeling, you really do. I know in my day you had to be above 5'7.5". I mean, you could be a junior model at like 5'7", 5'7.5". And then there were some girls who were maybe a little shorter than that who were commercial models. So, you know, who really did TV commercials more than anything else. And
that's where I found my home. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's not such a height. Requirement, you know, but for the kind of model I was, you know, magazines and fashion and things, and you really do, I think, have to probably be 5'8 or more. And I think if a young girl is that age, I think it's not a bad thing for her to do, as long as she doesn't start too young. I don't believe in this 14 and 15 year old girls going to New York to model. I think it's just too soon. I mean, some of them become overnight successes, and it throws them into a world that I don't believe they're prepared for.
Yeah.
You know, I told Kimberly she wanted to model, and I said, well, you know, I let her do a few things when she was 16 here at home, but I was not about to let her work full-time, you know, until she had graduated. And, I think that that's important. I think the education is important. And I just think, you know, it's just like I think you have to be mature enough to handle what's going to get thrown at you, you know, and if you should be an overnight success and you're thrown into that world, wow, I mean, look, there's a lot of girls that couldn't handle it. You know, we've seen stories about them. And, you know, I wasn't that kind of model. I didn't become overnight famous. I had to work my butt off, and at least it felt like I schlepped around forever trying to get pictures. And it wasn't that long looking back. It just seemed like it was then, you know, before I got photographed by a good photographer and got into some of the good magazines. And but I think it's a great profession for a young woman, but I think it's more of a means to an end, I would say, you know, to, unless you become a supermodel like a Cindy Crawford or somebody, and you can, you know, you can take that then and brand it and go on and do furniture and clothing and, you know, all those kind of things. I think it's a means to an end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
You know, and very good pay and very good experience. If you have, I mean, I had Eileen looking over me. She was kind of like a mother hen. And I, even though I came from Texas and didn't, you know, and came up there by myself and I was very young, I was pretty independent.
Yeah.
I had grown up pretty independent. I was an only child. But I just do think it's really important to really watch over your young girl if she wants to do that.
Now, also, I'm just very, very curious. What are some of the things or tricks or all the things that you do to just, you're so beautiful. I mean, I'm saying it out loud. I mean, you are just absolutely beautiful.
Well, you're sweet, and I don't feel it. I feel like I used to be, and when I used to be beautiful, I mean really beautiful, I didn't think I was, okay? I never thought I was. Yeah. I always looked at my face and thought, my face is too long, my chin is this, my forehead's too high, my legs are too skinny, I'm too flat-chested.
We're our worst critics, aren't we?
I know. I never thought, boy, are you beautiful.
Katie always says that to me. Katie says, you're so beautiful. I'm like, oh, my gosh, if my rear end gets any fatter, I don't know what I'm going to do.
But it's true, we don't. You know, I don't
fit in my car.
I don't know any woman who thinks I'm really hot. Well, there are some, I guess, that thank God I'm really fabulous.
did Farrah walk around going, I am just beautiful? I mean, that kind of thing.
No,
I don't think so. I don't think she ever did, yeah.
You know, we would say, I'd go, God, I can't stand my skinny legs. I wish I had, your legs are so great. She'd go, no, she said, I can't stand my legs. They're like a guy's legs. They're too butch. They're too athletic. I want, like, nice, thin legs like yours. And
oh, gosh, so you guys did fight about who was cuter and who was
not. You know,
so funny.
I'm sure she had to have known at the height of her glory that she was one of the most gorgeous women walking, but I don't know, you know, I don't know if we ever
feel
too. That.
I mean, so you don't,
but
you,
I
you
never
seriously
felt it.
Don't think, oh my gosh.
I never felt it. And now I feel like, you know, like I feel like I'm 100 years old and I do though now, I think I've come so far in my inner growth, which I think is the most important thing. And if we say nothing else that about beauty, I feel that inner beauty is the most important of it all. Forget about all the other stuff, and that comes from, you know, spiritual work and working on yourself and being a better person. And I think that is ultimately the most important thing. And I think what I know about myself now is I know I look really great for my age. I haven't had plastic surgery. I'm really lucky. I'm really fortunate. And I've just come through a lot in my life, and I feel like I'm a good person, and I feel good about myself. I never felt, when I was younger, I didn't have a lot of self-esteem. You know, I always felt there was something wrong with me, or I was doing it wrong, or I just wasn't good enough.
Boy, join the club.
Well,
no, really.
Well, I mean, that's the thing that women do to themselves, though. I mean, I really am searching for a woman with the most amazing self-esteem in the world, and I think we find them when they go a little bit over 40 and on up, when they discover that, you know, having the longest, blondest hair and being the skinniest isn't the most important anymore. It's really how you treat people and how you treat other people and everything. And that's really why I founded Best Ever You. That's why I started the company, was to really help people be their best inside out, whether it's your hair, your checkbook, your shoes or whatever, and, you know, or your inner growth and your spirituality, to help people be their best.
Well, that's
right. And, they go
and
together.
And final analysis, it's how you feel about yourself. And if women in their 20s and 30s could just stop, and any advice I could give them, this is the most important, just stop and look at your era and say, you know, however you want to say it, I am good enough. God put me here. I'm here. I am good enough, just like I am.
Right. Right. Well, and you know, there's one other thing, too, that you said earlier, which I would say is a definite butterfly blessing, because I got chills when you said it. Farah's immediate response when she got cancer was to make a difference. And I think one of the things that makes you beautiful, Alana, is you're really making a difference. And I'll tell you a really quick story, because it's very beautiful, and that is, 3 days before a little 8-year-old guy died, he told his mom that the purpose of life is to make a difference.
Oh,
and when she said to him, well, how do you know that? And I didn't. He said, well, you did, but you grew up. And I want you to, because we've only got a few more minutes, I want you to tell people about the beautiful work you're doing with the foundation.
Oh, that story about that little boy, that just breaks my heart.
And that's my book. That's my book. Is there are so many beautiful stories of how before someone dies, they make a difference. So can you take a few minutes and talk about the foundation?
You know, before Farah died, she started this foundation, and that's exactly why she started it, you know, because she felt that she could make a difference. And she left actually a large part of her estate to the foundation. And that was a very, very important thing to her, and the fact that I get to be president of it is I think the most important thing that I've ever done in my life, and the most rewarding. And I never would have dreamed that this is where I would be at this point in my life or what I would be doing, but it's the most rewarding thing. And just really quickly, I got a letter from a family. There's a little boy named, he's actually 13, I think, Brian Wilson. I hope his family don't mind if I speak about him, but he had to have his leg amputated because of osteosarcoma. And I saw him when I was down in Houston at MD Anderson meeting with some doctors. I happened to meet with his doctor because she was doing some research that we may be able to help out in. Anyway, a long story short, I met this young man who, in his hospital bed, was the bravest, most incredible, just beautiful soul. Yeah. And he inspired us to start this, which we're trying to do in different places, this Farah Fawcett Foundation Patient Assistance Fund, and it's to help families that are struggling with cancer and that are having financial concerns because of the overwhelming bills and things, and private foundations, you can't give directly to people, but through this fund with the institution, we can help people. And I'm putting on it in honor of Brian Wilson, because he's just hearing his story and then finally meeting him is what inspired me to come up with the idea to do that.
Wonderful.
So we only have 30 seconds left, and I would really like to invite you back on our show, and I'm going to we have to end on that note. And So it's FarrahFawcettFoundation.org.
It's
and
FarrahFawcettFoundation.org.
Okay. Oh,
you have to
Thank
put the
you,
in front of it because there was someone that had the other, you know, some poacher.
Okay.
So it's FarrahFawcettFoundation.org. And people can
go
there,
Alana.
They can donate, they can see pictures of her and read about her. And thank you both. This has really been a great pleasure.
It has been.
Much.
Thank you, Alana. And thank you for all the things you're doing.
Well, thank you both. And I've really enjoyed this and love to talk to you again sometime.
Great.
You have
all
a
right.
great day.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye.